Today on Against the Grain, hostility to unions, lax environmental regulations, and perhaps less obviously, far-flung rural communities. All of these helped give birth to our express delivery buy-on-credit economy. Environmental historian Bart Elmore considers the importance of the American South to the genesis, reach, and ecological damage of five outsized corporations: Walmart, Coca-Cola, FedEx, Bank of America, and Delta Airlines. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. While Amazon may epitomize contemporary U.S. capitalism, the road to Amazon was paved by Coca-Cola, FedEx, Delta Airlines, Walmart, and Bank of America. In Country Capitalism, How Corporations from the American South Remade Our Economy and Our Planet, Bart Elmore examines how these companies transformed logistics and transport, creating a highly profitable infrastructure and paradigm for the movement of goods and credit, and, as he explores, one that's done great damage ecologically. Elmore is professor of environmental history at Ohio State University. Bart, I wanted to begin by asking you why you chose to focus on these five companies. Tell us what they have in common.
I grew up in the American South. I grew up in Atlanta in the 1980s and 1990s. And one answer is that I was surrounded and kind of these companies were right in my face. Coca-Cola, Delta Airlines, of course, but even Walmart, FedEx, and others. Bank of America being in Charlotte, which is just a short jaunt from where I'm from. And, you know, when I left the American South and went off to school in New Hampshire and then ultimately California and other places, I studied the history of the American South. I studied the history of American capitalism, the economy, and I was really struck by how the American South figured into that story. There was a lot of discussion of American agriculture, of textiles, even the oil industry, but there were these companies that I think both in finance and retail and other sectors of the economy that came out of the American South that were having a huge impact. I mean, you think about Walmart being based out of Bentonville, Arkansas, is one of the largest corporations in the world. And yet, you know, for some reason, we don't think of the South as the center of a kind of logistics revolution that was reshaping the way that we run our economy. And so I think these companies, for better or worse, get at one of the gaps that I thought was really big, which was thinking about these companies that revolutionized transportation, Delta Airlines in some ways. You know, Coca-Cola, there's hardly a product that you can think of that has that kind of ubiquitous reach. How did they do it? And what was it about the South that explains why Coke, you know, was able to be such a global brand? How could Walmart start in Bentonville, Arkansas, a town of a few thousand people, and become the largest corporation in the world? And Bank of America, what is it about Charlotte? I mean, why, you know, San Francisco has certainly a very storied financial history that I write about, but what was it about North Carolina that explains how it became a center of kind of some of these big financial firms moving forward?
Do you feel like in some ways the South has been somewhat discounted as a backwater in the 20th century and that the history of capitalism, U.S. capitalism, has taken place elsewhere? And in effect, by examining these five, you know, world-spanning companies and looking at their roots in the South, you're sort of rectifying that tale a bit.
For me, I think there was always a sense of recognizing the place of the American South in a larger story. And as you said, but yet it being treated as a backwater. The challenge for me was trying to get the tone right, because I'm also not a person who's trying to say, rah, 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 the South. In fact, you hear about the horrors of Jim Crow segregation, about really the problems that these Southern companies helped create as much as the solutions. But the point was to say precisely that, that if we don't understand Southern history correctly, then we miss this whole story. And I think the way our textbooks treat the American South is it's a kind of appendage to the larger story of American history. Like, you know, and then in the old South, I always remember that in my textbooks. It's kind of, we would, and then back to the story, you know, what's happening with the railroads and everything else. But it turns out that when we see the South embedded in the very fabric of what we might call our, quote, Amazon economy, which I think stems from all these companies, we recognize that we're all complicit in some of the problems, injustices, the environmental effects that came out of the South.
You've written extensively elsewhere about Coca-Cola.
For me, what was so interesting was seeing that earlier history of how it evolved as a material product. And it was a very Southern story. I mean, it started with a guy named John Pemberton, who was a Civil War veteran coming out of the Civil War in Columbus, Georgia, which is south of, South Georgia, south of Atlanta. He was a pharmacist, and the Civil War actually matters because, like many young people, men, he was wounded, slashed with a saber and shot during a battle in April of 1865. And for any historians of the Civil War out there, they're saying, wait a minute, April of 1865, isn't the war over? And that's true. He basically is wounded at a time when it doesn't matter. Lee and Grant are signing the terms of surrender at Appomattox Courthouse that month in April. And he will forever be shaped by that because he is a pharmacist. So he has access to morphine. And he starts taking drugs to try and deal with some of his stomach pains, which by all accounts, according to the historical record, are terrible. He's laid up a lot and his friends are worried about him. And he moves to the big city of Atlanta out of Columbus to try and strike it rich in the era of Reconstruction. And, you know, his business burns down not once but twice in Atlanta. He goes bankrupt. I always tell my students here at Ohio State, if you're keeping track here, it does not sound like the person who's going to create the biggest brand the world's ever known. You've got a person who's addicted to drugs, who's sick, who has no money, and his business is burned down. And, you know, I think it shows you even the globalness of the American South and the connectedness of a place that we like to think of as you said, a backwater at that time. He's very much connected to these international discussions about pharmacy. He's looking at products like the coca leaf coming out of Peru, which comes from the coca shrub in the Andes. He's actually thinking of that maybe as his methadone, you might say, his way of getting off of morphine. So these are, you know, again, the history of the Civil War and the South is all connected to even the design of what he's trying to do. He's trying to deal with his morphine addiction that he got from war wounds, and he ultimately finds the coca leaf and decides to pursue a drink that might sell. He's in the patent medicine market, which does really well in the South. A lot of people are looking in an era of insecurity and urbanization and industrialization for some kind of solution to their nerves and the changes in society. And he creates this drink that's a complete copy of Vin Mariani, which is a red wine mixed with the coca leaf that comes from South America that would have infused the wine with small quantities of the alkaloid cocaine. And basically, everyone loved it. The Queen of Victoria of England drank it. The Pope drank it. I always say Catholics, you know, this would be quite a communion to have, you know, coca leaf wine. But it was completely accepted. There were no national laws banning cocaine. And again, Pemberton's seeing this as a solution to his morphine problem. And so he copies it and he sells this wine. It was an alcohol mixed with the coca leaf. And it does well by all accounts, but he has to sell it for $1 a bottle. So it's mainly for kind of upper class people. It doesn't have that low price point of 5 cents, which it would later have when he takes out the wine. And, you know, the last part of the story is simply that the city of Atlanta bans the sale of alcohol right as he discovers this drink that's selling. And you can imagine this guy is trying to scrape himself back, finally has a winner that he's copied, by the way, from another company. Vin Mariani came out of France. And yet he's forced to reformulate the drink. And so, South matters here because prohibition is not national, you know, until we get to the 1920s. But in the Protestant South, you have this kind of conservative temperance movement taking off that bans the sale of alcohol. So even the shape of the drink, Coca-Cola, is shaped by that because he's forced to take out the wine. He replaces it with carbonated water. And voila, in 1886, you have this drink, Coca-Cola. So it turns out history matters, I think, at every turn in understanding why the drink is the way it is today.
I'm speaking with Bart Elmore. He's an environmental historian and author of Country Capitalism, How Corporations from the American South Remade Our Economy and Our Planet. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, one thing that is striking in the story of Coca-Cola, not just the South, but the rural South, small town South, play a key role in the flourishing of this company, like the other companies that you focus on, Walmart, FedEx, Delta Airlines, and Bank of America. Can you talk about the importance of rural communities in the growth of Coca-Cola?
Sasha, it's always a delight to talk to somebody who reads the book closely and goes straight to the heart of what I care about, because you nailed it. I mean, for me, what united all these firms, and I wasn't necessarily certain that all these companies, Coca-Cola, Delta Airlines, Walmart, FedEx, and Bank of America, which make up this book, that there was going to be a clear connection between these companies I really wanted to write about. I knew they all revolutionized various aspects of the economy, and that's why I kind of chose them. I also left out certain companies like KFC and others, partially because I felt like the history of ag and the South had been well documented, especially chicken processing and things like that by other historians. I was kind of trying to focus on some firms that maybe didn't get the same level of attention in terms of the way I was looking at them. And you nailed it. I mean, one of the things that really struck me is that all these companies made money by what I call country capitalism, by focusing on rural markets, that they really saw rurality as an asset, not a hindrance to American capitalism. And in fact, I argue in the book that the rural roads to our Amazon economy went straight through the American South. And maybe we can return to that later when I think about Jeff Bezos and Amazon, how they built on some of the models that we see here in this book. But Coke is a great example, right? I mean, as they're emerging in the, I said 1886, you know, Pemberton actually dies. He never gets to see this brand become what it is. And the brand is taken over by another pharmacist, Asa Candler, who reluctantly agrees to bottle Coca-Cola for the first time in 1899. And there have been some other folks who tried to bottle it in the 1890s, but it really, bottling takes off for Coca-Cola in 1899. And I say reluctantly because he was a small town guy. He grew up in Villa Rica, Asa Candler did, which is just outside of Atlanta. He wanted to come to the big city. You know, he was one of those guys who said, I want to be where the action's at. But it turns out that people convinced him that there's a huge market if you can get this thing into the countryside. And that was the actual phrasing I found in the archives where people were saying, hey, man, it's not about the soda fountains, which is where Coke was originally sold. It was sold, you know, at soda fountains like the bar. It would be a syrup that would be added to, you know, some carbonated water, and it'd be this kind of social event at the soda fountain. And Candler thought that was the whole point, that people liked being in that space and the kind of social aspects and, let's be honest, kind of white middle-class culture that he was targeting in a Jim Crow era of segregation, as segregation's taking off in the South. But being convinced in 1899 to try this out was the right thing for Coke, because it turns out that bottling, as we know now, became one of the primary means through which they generated profit. And the key was figuring out how to get this product into every little nook and cranny you could possibly imagine. And that became, I would argue, like the key secret formula for Coke was like figuring out the techniques for how you do that. And a lot of that involved outsourcing, you know, a lot of the cost with maintaining that bottling network by allowing this kind of franchise system to grow and put the risks really on the bottlers, who had to pay for the water, the trucks, you know, take out the loans. It's about $3,000 to $3,500 in the early 1900s, which is not a small amount of money to start some of these medium-sized bottling plants for Coca-Cola. But that capital could come from local banks. You know, Robert Woodruff, who I mentioned earlier, took over the company in the 20s. He said, great line. He said, you know, you can do a lot of things if you don't care who gets the credit. And it sounds nice, but the truth was it was practical. The point was to try and kind of let others do the hard work of getting this product into those country markets, kind of staying at arm's length from owning things, which I would argue is a signature of Coca-Cola's profitability, not owning its distribution system really not for much of its history, not owning, you know, the supply chains like the sugar plantations or the caffeine processing plants. but kind of being a middleman in the economy. And you know, taking in all those goods, repackaging them from independent suppliers, and then sending them out to independently owned bottlers and kind of making money off the transaction, but never really owning that infrastructure. And as a result, they were able to spread really quickly. They were in every state in the country by the end of the 1890s. And they quickly go global with this model as we move into the 30s and 40s. Trucking, of course, became part of the way they did that. So it turns out that the countryside market was so key to Coca-Cola, even though someone like Asa Candler, who comes from the country, wanted to be in the city, but later finds out that it's in the rural spaces. If you can get things to the rural markets and you can figure out how to do that, you can become a really powerful company. So, and I think we see that in the case of many of the other companies as well.
Yeah, so talk about that. Tell us about Delta Airlines, another Southern company, the importance of that kind of decentralized structure or infrastructure.
Mississippi Delta, that's why it's called Delta. And, you know, the number of times people go, oh, okay, you know. I know that Delta's headquarters, their hub is in Atlanta, but, you know, I never made the connection to the actual South, the Mississippi Delta, which is where the name comes from. And so, you know, for me, I really wanted to unpack how important Delta Airlines was in shaping, you know, the airline industry. And by association, I think other industries like FedEx and Express Shipping. Delta started as a crop dusting company in Monroe, Louisiana. And it was ag. Once again, we see the importance of servicing the countryside is getting Delta off the ground. Commercial aviation was in its infancy, you know, after World War I, and passenger flight was really not that profitable because you didn't have planes that had powerful enough engines, et cetera, to be able to make passenger flight worth it. And so much of how these businesses would grow was through either getting mail contracts to ship mail with the U.S. Post or to do things like what Delta Airlines did in its early years, servicing farmers by crop dusting with chemicals, especially at a time when the boll weevil, this pest that was ravaging cotton farms in the American South and the Mississippi Delta, was becoming so problematic. So Delta really got its start, if you think about environmental impacts, by spraying pesticides that were particularly toxic, one should note, in the early part of the 20th century throughout the American South. And I should also mention that agriculture mattered because you have different, you have opposite growing seasons in other parts of the world. So Delta was very quickly trying to find business in when it was winter here in summer markets in other parts of the world, and therefore going global kind of earlier, in part because they were focusing on the agricultural markets and agricultural communities. So rurality, once again, I think helped shape Delta. And just to put a fine point on that, as we move forward in the 1940s, that's when Delta moved its headquarters to Atlanta, much to the chagrin of people who may have to fly through there and the crazy traffic that is now. Trust me, as somebody who grew up there, it was quite frustrating. But it's all connected. I should mention that if you fly in Atlanta Hartsfield International Airport, that was the racetrack that Asa Candler of Coca-Cola built on the south side of the city using Coca-Cola money. And it later was given over to the city to become this huge airport because it has particularly flat topography and had all these benefits. But Coke was actually there in the middle of it. But again, what made Delta different than, say, other companies is they're operating in a South that really hasn't hit its prime yet. A lot of the big cities in the South are just beginning to grow as the Sun Belt explodes in the World War II post-war era. And as a result, Delta has to figure out how to generate traffic. So they came up with the kind of hub and spoke model that drives all of us wild. That is to say, taking people from smaller towns in the American South, flying them into Atlanta, and then then flying them out to maybe some of the bigger cities like San Francisco or, you know, New York or other places. And that hub and spoke model, which they really developed in 1955, became the model for many of the airlines that we now use today. And frankly, for companies like FedEx that figured out that that hub and spoke model, bringing in packages from smaller markets into one location and then sending them out from that hub, is a more profitable way to do things. So rurality, or one could argue a less urban environment of the American South, figured into this kind of model that became I think, emblem of the way our transportation system and even air shipment works today.
Tell us more about how FedEx drew on the innovations of Delta and that model, that hub and spoke transport model, and where FedEx then took that.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't just about beverages, and this isn't just about aviation. It turns out that there's connections here to a larger kind of logistics revolution that's coming out of the South. FedEx is based in Memphis, Tennessee. I was fortunate to get to connect with Fred Smith, who is the head of this company. And I should note that I feel very fortunate in this book to have interviewed the CEO of Bank of America, a former CEO, Hugh McCall, to try and get insights from the businesses themselves on how they operated. And in this case, they're based in Memphis, Tennessee, which at first glance, people might say, well, why? Why is this company that revolutionized Air Express delivery based in Memphis? And the environment mattered. It turns out that Fred Smith wanted to be far enough south from cities like Chicago, which were in the middle of the country, which you could argue gives them access to both coasts. But they wanted to be far enough south to avoid the snow, which would have disrupted air traffic, in a critical industry that cares a lot about time. They also wanted to be far enough north to be avoiding the Gulf Coast, storms that might hit Houston or New Orleans or other places. And so Memphis was kind of in that perfect sweet spot in the middle of the country, but also weather-wise, far enough south and north. And the idea was that it was a hub-and-spoke model. They looked, and Fred Smith said this very directly, that they were looking at Delta and that kind of hub-and-spoke model, and trying to see if they could create the same thing for FedEx, taking small packages from small markets, bringing them in overnight to Memphis, and then out overnight, arriving the next day in markets as far away as San Francisco, Los Angeles, and elsewhere. From an environmental standpoint, you can think about the carbon emissions associated with that. A hub and spoke, if you're sending something from Greenville, South Carolina to let's just say Atlanta. They're very close. For those who might not know, you could drive it within a few hours, but you're flying that all the way to Memphis to the hub and then back out to Atlanta. But from a profitability standpoint and kind of economies of scale and trying to figure out how you make money off this, it made a lot of sense. And so, again, we see this kind of connection to Delta, the hub and spoke model, but also these local environmental factors that made Memphis kind of the perfect place to do this. Last thing I'll say is there was already Air Express delivery. It's not like this was just invented in the 1970s, which is when FedEx started. But what FedEx did was they were focusing on those smaller markets. That was the key difference. You had things you could ship on airlines from New York to San Francisco because you already had passenger travel to those big cities. But these smaller regional markets, especially in the Midwest and South, were not being served. And so by focusing on what they called the small package market, they were able to carve out this niche that led to this, global empire that now, flies all the way across the world doing these Air Express deliveries.
Well, you've been arguing that the context in which these companies developed matters, that is, the U.S. South. And I wanted to ask you about labor and how the fact that much of the South has been a place where union density is much less, there's hostility toward unions, how has that factored into the economic success and profitability of companies like FedEx?
It was foundational to have their model. I mean, Fred Smith was rabidly anti-union, rabidly anti-regulation as well. Though one, notes in this chapter how much the government facilitated the rise of all of these businesses, even though at every turn they're trying to, prevent any type of federal intervention into their operations. One of the most notable for FedEx was using the VA to retrain pilots coming out of the Vietnam War and other conflicts to become these, really high pressure, one could argue, probably not as high pressure as wartime, but certainly not as high pressure, but, training these folks to be the ideal kind of FedEx pilots who can deliver these things overnight. And so these training programs that benefit FedEx, Delta benefits as well from what's called the Essential Air Service in this in that chapter, which is a program most people don't know about that keeps rural airports operating. It's essentially a federal subsidy that allows for Delta to fly out of smaller markets like Muscle Shoals, Alabama, where the statistics show that maybe on any given flight out of Muscle Shoals to maybe say Atlanta, some of these flights are filled to like 35-36% capacity. And you might ask yourself when you're on those flights, how is this profitable? It turns out there's a federal program that's designed to make sure that small airports are sustained. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I certainly would point out from a perspective of climate change, you know, you have planes filled at 30% capacity, maybe not the most efficient use of fossil fuel resources. On the other hand, you have the kind of policy issue of not wanting rural communities to lose their airports and their flights. So the point of this is to say that, you know, a lot of these businesses were rabidly, Walmart certainly, anti-union, FedEx as well, really wanted government kind of to stay away from their affairs. And yet they were feeding off that at every turn. And I think it matters when we think about this. When Jeff Bezos creates Amazon in the 1990s, he flies to Bentonville, Arkansas. He hires most of his people from Walmart. In fact, Walmart challenges them and tries to suggest that they're stealing their top talent. He also, at his first warehouse, hires folks from FedEx. These were the companies that actually gave Jeff Bezos the ground game in the early years from the South to build out his business. But if you pay attention to what you just mentioned, that these were the same states, if we think about Arkansas, for example, where Walmart starts, which passes one of the first right-to-work laws in American history coming out of the World War II, same thing in states like Tennessee. These are states that are selling the South, as one Southern historian, Jim Cobb, put it. They're selling an anti-union market. They're selling a lax environmental regulation market. And that is what allowed FedEx to create those low prices, you know, and Walmart the same thing. If you're not having a unionized workforce that can bargain for wages, you've got an ability to create goods on the cheap. The problem with that is we think about the Amazon economy is it's, as I said, they're hiring FedEx, they're hiring Walmart, they're building off that model. And one could argue that it's a model that in which workers are often not empowered. And we're seeing that, I think, even today with Amazon, you know, having strikes and various things as workers try and fight for higher wages. But it comes out of a Southern story in some ways of states that were fighting for companies like FedEx, fighting for companies like Walmart, and saying, hey, look, come here. We're not going to have an environment in which labor unions are strong. So I think it was a critical aspect to the rise of these firms.
Environmental historian Bart Elmore is my guest. We're discussing country capitalism, how corporations from the American South remade our economy and our planet. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, you mentioned not long ago Walmart, and Walmart, of course, is notorious for paying its workers low wages and fighting unions. And yet, at the same time, Walmart is often faulted for undermining the economies of rural areas. I wonder if you could talk about how Walmart itself both came out of and shaped the rural economy of the South as part of its model, and how it too fed into one of the hallmarks of contemporary capitalism around the centrality of supply chains.
I think it's a great question because, you know, Walmart is starts in Bentonville, Arkansas, which is in northwest Arkansas in the kind of hill country of the Ozarks, in a town of a few thousand people. And rurality, once again, is the key ingredient. This is an odd technique, right, that Sam Walton, who founded Walmart in 1962, is adopting. Because if you think about the big box stores that were emerging in 1962, Kmart is coming out of Detroit. You have Target coming out of Minneapolis. the same year as Walmart has its first store in 1962. That's the kind of moment of these big box retail stores. They were focusing on urban and more suburban markets, and rightly so. I mean, you're going to have tens of thousands of square feet of store space, and you're going to operate in a town of 5,000 people, which is what Walmart did. What do you mean? I mean, how on earth are you going to generate the foot traffic to warrant that? Turns out with the Interstate Highway Act of 1956, it worked. Sam Walton predicted that people will drive 50, 60 miles if you can offer, as they put it, the low, low prices, which goes back to how do you get that? Well, you know, cheap labor markets and lax environmental regulations and everything else. People will drive that distance over those highways. And he proved a model that I think has reshaped our economy. I mean, he proved that you could put a store in Rogers, Arkansas, which is right next to Bentonville, a few thousand people, and generate millions of dollars in revenue. And people will drive. If you build it, they will come to this location. You know, as I've talked about access, and in this case, I've actually been able to interview Sam Walton, who died in 1992. And if you pause for a second, you're saying, wait a minute, how did a historian interview Sam Walton in 1992? But it turns out that Sam Walton has been brought back to life as artificial intelligence. And so if there's any historians out there, and it turns out that interviewing AI versions of deceased people may be the future of history, you can go, yeah, or potentially a terrible idea. But in this case, I found it very useful. They had essentially taken all his speeches and all of his autobiography and created this this hologram, which you can visit in Bentonville. He sits in a box. He stands up when you ask him questions. He does the little Walmart cheer. And, you know, it's funny because I asked these kind of questions like, so, you know, how did you feel about the environment? And, you know, very targeted questions related to my project. So much so that I kind of blew my cover. In fact, there was somewhat of a manager there who came over, and I was startled because I didn't know they knew I was there. It said, you know, I'd said that I might be coming, but it wasn't sure I was going to be there that day. And they said, are you Bart Elmore? You know, based on the questions I was asking as a historian, too pesky than maybe the 10-year-old who was just wowed by the hologram who was asking, you know, can we do the Walmart cheer? But it turns out if you do talk to Sam Walton, the AI, he'll talk about the environment because it was critical. Like he knew that as he put it, he was hiding out in those hills, that Target and Kmart and these bigger retailers, he actually started at JCPenney. But, you know, thinking about Kmart and these big box stores, we're looking at those markets that they weren't paying attention to the markets he was focusing on in the Ozarks and in the South and in the Midwest. They were kind of a retail landscape that was right for him. And even the environment of the Ozarks, very hilly, and he would drive to his stores on these winding roads. He got tired of it. He got his pilot's license. So the environment pushed him up into the air. And he said that changed everything. He said he was, you know, decades ahead of his competitors and being able to see where these highway systems were going and being out in front of the retail markets, becoming the market, where the market was going. And therefore, you know, really benefiting from having almost a vision for where the American economy was headed and then capitalizing on that, becoming the only store in town, big box store, I should say, in these places. But the last thing I'll say is what you highlighted. I mean, it turns out rurality, in other words, was key to what made Walmart great. By being in a small market, it kind of had this growth pattern where it was able to expand out of sight from Target and Kmart, and then becoming the largest retailer and then the largest corporation of any kind, not just retailer, in the world by the end of the 20th century. In fact, if you think about this, they developed the most sophisticated technology systems of any corporation. If I think one of the largest mainframe computers in the world by the early 2000s was the Pentagon, and then number two was in Bentonville, Arkansas. Because it turns out figuring out the logistics of how you get these things to these small markets requires you to have a sophisticated computer system, and that then became the envy of folks like Amazon and other places. So rurality was key, but it turns out rurality was also a real threat. And as they moved into rural areas and other parts of the country, especially more affluent rural communities like Williston, Vermont, which was the last stand, if you will, the last state, Vermont, to not have a Walmart, you know, the communities push back saying, not only are you going to get rid of our local hardware store, which we like, but it's going to ruin the environmental aesthetic of our entire town. And So the chapter also documents that backlash in the 1990s and onwards as communities said, we don't want a Walmart here, not just because it's going to hurt local businesses, but because, and of course that was debated, Walmart saying, it doesn't do that, but a lot of people saying we're going to lose those local hardware stores. But the bigger argument I think was missed in those debates is how much environment played into that, where people are saying it's just ugly and it's going to have these huge effects on our roadways and, you know, the emissions of pollution coming in as cars drive in. So rurality was both an ingredient that made it grow, but it was also kind of a threat to it. We'll get to the latter part of the 20th century.
Listeners might wonder why you include Bank of America with Walmart and Coca-Cola and FedEx and Delta Airlines, you know, the others shuttling things around. Why is Bank of America and consumer credit essential to this story?
Well, I'd first have to say it's because of my pesky editor who wouldn't let me get rid of it. And he was right. Mark Simpson Voss at the UNC Press, who is just a fantastic, fantastic editor. A shout out to the fact that we as historians can only do our work, but for a team of just talented people who really, help us see paths that we wouldn't otherwise see. And I think, you know, this is UNC Press and they're based out of North Carolina, and Charlotte was a place I knew well. And I think it was the right move to consider Bank of America, which is now the headquarters, is in Charlotte, because you don't have any of this stuff if you don't have people being able to use credit cards to be able to quickly purchase goods, on these Amazon websites and everything else. In fact, when I got to the end, I realized how right the Mark was in pushing for Bank of America, because I read Jeff Bezos's, I don't know if they'd be called autobiographies yet or whatever, musings on his life. And he credits almost immediately FedEx. He says, for example, I could not have built this company but for the infrastructure on which I built it. And he mentions FedEx. And one of the things he mentions right away is the credit card. And you can even think about Amazon has its own credit card. So they even recognize that being in that space was key. But Bank of America was the first bank to issue a commercial credit card. And it was extremely successful. The Bank of America card actually proved to other banks that you could do it. And I should say here, this is part California story.
Bank of America actually comes out of California.
Yeah, as the Bank of Italy. And I knew that well because I studied in Giannini Hall at the University of California. And I did my postdoc there. And, you know, Giannini starts this bank as the Bank of Italy in the early 1900s. It actually becomes quite big in part because of the earthquake in San Francisco in 1906 that devastates the city. And he is one of those folks lending out money to rebuild the city and seen as kind of a hero in that moment because he's willing to lend not only to, and this goes back to country capitalism, to the kind of business magnates of the town, but in fact, being a person who had grown up in just north of San Jose and had been connected to all these agricultural communities, he became a person who really believed in the small farmer or as a person who was credit worthy. And most banks didn't do that. At that time, you know, lending consumer credit was fairly restricted. And so there's completely a California component to this story. It's not just the South. And it was also a great opportunity for me to point that out. The idea that rurality and servicing the countryside is that the South or Southern companies have some kind of monopoly on that model is, of course, not true. Chicago had Sears, and it was all about trying to get things to rural markets and became one of the biggest businesses by trying to figure out how to do that. And here we see, you know, this happening in a state like California, which had lax branching rules for their banks. That's what made Bank of America so successful. You could branch across the state and have branches opening up in Los Angeles or down in the Central Valley, up in the Bay Area. And most states actually had restrictions on intrastate branching. California did not. And so, again, we see the story of country capitalism that really Bank of America became one of the largest farm banks in the country and then became the largest bank in the world as a result of trying to service those farmers, whether they be cotton growers in the Imperial Valley or dairy farmers up north, or we can think of the vineyards out in Sonoma in California. And by the way, Californians will understand this. You've got this diverse ecology, which diversifies your portfolio in terms of risk. So you maybe have a drought in the cotton farms of the south, but you've got these farms in the north that are doing fine, you know, because you have a different ecosystem and a different kind of market. And so then the question becomes, well, why the South? Well, it turns out that North Carolina shares the same thing as California. They were one of the few states that allowed lax intrastate branching. Most states were concerned that the big city banks would come in and gobble up all the business of rural banks. And so they prevented intrastate branching. But North Carolina and California were one of the few, and they're big states, that allowed you to branch across the country. And the same model was being followed there. A bank called NCNB was servicing, you know, cotton farmers, tobacco. And again, my point is to say this is all country capital. These banks, which we think of as kind of the high titans of finance and maybe, you know, investing in computers and big tech, really got its start by focusing on farms in countryside communities. And in doing so, they created a kind of consumer credit market that I think became the envy of the banking industry in many ways. You know, a lot of other companies would get into credit cards. Bank of America, again, started it in the 50s. And we see that becoming a key staple of it. One, again, that Jeff Bezos specifically mentions when saying, I could not have built my business but for the, you know, these commercial banks and their credit cards. So it turns out that having kind of buy on credit models and making sure that's available in all markets, not just in big cities, was part of the success of what we might call the Amazon economy we have today. I'll just say, when I say Amazon economy, I'm putting it in quotes, because as you can see, I'm suggesting that there's all this other infrastructure that made Bezos's business the billions, really, that he has now possible.
Right. And so I wanted to then ask you, so you've been talking about these companies that are structured around supply chains, the flow of goods, consumer credit that sort of greases the wheels for people to order something on their credit card. It then gets sent to them through a network like FedEx at quite a high environmental cost. Can you tell us what that environmental cost is, not just from the Delta Airlines is and FedEx's, but also the Bank of America's?
Right. You set up well, because I think when we think of environmental impacts, we often think of smokestacks, not coat racks. And we don't think of, you know, we think of the images, you know, and even think of our laws in the 1970s, the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act passed in the early 1970s. It's about regulating the pollution pipelines and the smokestacks that are coming out of actual manufacturing facilities. A big point of this book was trying to say we're missing the story. You know, retail, Walmart, as I said, became the largest corporation in the world. That pivot point started in the 70s and 80s, where retail stores, and one could argue banks, which weren't even at the top of the Fortune 500 listing back in 1977. I went back to look at the most profitable companies back then. It's not banks. It's U.S. Steel. It's General Motors. It's, you know, it's chemical companies. It turns out we live in a very different era, in which it's the retail giants, it's the banks that are really shaping our economy in powerful ways. I mean, Amazon, I mean, no one needs, I could show you the proof and statistics, but I feel like we even understand this as consumers, just inherently the power of these giants because of the systems that I write about in this book that gave them that ability to reach markets that no one thought was possible. And so that raises the question for me, and one that I do not have the answer to, which is why I love talking on shows like this, to think about the smart people who are listening, about a new era of regulation. If our laws were written at a time where chemical companies and steel companies and manufacturing plants were the giants of the day, what does it mean for environmental laws that we should write now when it's banks? Go look at the Fortune 500 today. You'll see the big banks. You'll see the big, you'll see Exxon, certainly, in the power of fossil fuels, but you'll also see Walmart and you'll see Amazon. Currently, the way we regulate these companies is by assessing how bad their parking lots are. you know, and the stormwater drain off of a Walmart parking lot, which turns out, as you'll see in the book, it's not good. It actually can radically reshape watersheds. But what we don't do is figure out, you know, what does it mean for a company to be able to transport overnight goods from China all the way to you know, some small town in rural Ohio, where I live here. FedEx, for example, you know, their sustainability reports are all about how much fuel they're using in their planes. Same thing with Delta. It turns out that that's problematic in and of itself because they're not actually reducing their emissions at a rate that is meeting the moment of climate change, again, as you'll see in the book. But I would say that's really only part of the story is their emissions coming from their operations. Who they choose to do business with, what they enable by creating those markets is the larger environmental footprint. And so the conclusion of this book is trying to get people to think about, well, what should our environmental regulations look like if the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, written in the 1970s, really don't see these businesses? And that includes the banks, you know, and now we're seeing with the post 2008 legislation like the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010, which tried to provide new regulations to prevent predatory lending in terms of the subprime, you know, mortgage market. Well, if we have laws like that, and given the size of these banks, which now control trillions of dollars with a T as opposed to billions of dollars of assets, can we make radical changes to our economy by focusing on these players, the conduits of capital, you know, that are channeling goods around the country? If we regulate the gateways of our economy, can we have rapid and big changes? Now, what that looks like, I don't know. I'm a historian. That's the future. But it strikes me as a historian that I have an obligation to hold out the reality that our laws are not seeing these powerful companies and the big impacts they're having, which means we have a big gap when it comes to dealing with the environmental effects they're having.
Well, let me end with this question then. Given what you've just described, the paramount importance of these companies in our economy and the infrastructure that they've created, you know, in many ways, what you're also describing sounds like something that is also vulnerable because it is about passing, you know, goods through certain circuits. But could it be argued that if those circuits were disrupted in some way, let's just say by activists, environmental activists, or labor activists, that the effects could be disproportionate because of the way it's all structured?
Absolutely. And I think we're seeing environmentalists recognizing exactly what you said. In other words, a real shift, and you see this in the book, of organizations like the Rainforest Action Network, even the Sierra Club and others saying, okay, going after every single polluting plant seems to be a kind of fool's errand in terms of being able to marshal resources and have effect at a time where we need to move rapidly. I was fortunate this year to be at COP28 in Dubai, the UN Climate Summit, with 10 students, brilliant students here from Ohio State. And one of the things I think they've shown me is that that's the new era of environmental activism. These are folks who are on the front lines of the climate battles, and they're not focusing necessarily on that single plan or that single institution, but they're looking at businesses like Citi. They're looking at banks like Bank of America and saying, okay, or endowments, and okay, how can we change the flows of capital before the pollution problem begins? You know, don't go to the plant at the end of the life cycle, start upstream. And I think they are vulnerable in that sense. I think our legislation around climate and finance suggests that we may enter a new era where those businesses now have to recognize they're going to be the center and target of environmental activism. And I'll just add one other thing. For those, you know, my students, are many of them will go off to Deloitte or consulting firms like McKinsey and others. There's a whole other sector of scholars who are saying, what about what some have called the enablers, institutions that have been largely out of sight, but that, you know, have big dollar value, who are giving advice to corporations about things that lead to climate outcomes or pollution outcomes that are problematic to the public. Will those institutions as well face some blowback moving forward? And frankly, will they be legally held liable? I remember seeing some of my students who were entering Deloitte, like literally perking up saying, wait a minute, I'm going to work for a consulting firm. That's going to make me think about the decisions I'm making. And I thought, that's probably a good thing, right? What advice are you giving companies? Is, in other words, the era of corporate liability expanding in terms of who is going to be the target of this activism? I'll tell you, given the climate, the need to act now on climate, and having been on the front lines of this, I can tell you the science is clear. We have to move fast. And that's not, you know, that's just data that is that when you are in the room and you're listening to what the top scientists are telling us, we have to move fast. And so I think we're right as environmental organizations and others who are protesting this to target these conduits of capitalism, to think about a new era of regulation, too, that moves us faster than having to track down every bad actor in the economy. So we'll see if that prophecy holds true. Usually historians are wrong, but I think we see this in the record even now in the last couple of decades.
Bart Elmer, thank you so much.
This was a pleasure. Thanks, Sasha.
I've been speaking with Bart Elmer. He's professor of environmental history at Ohio State University. We've been speaking about country capitalism, how corporations from the American South remade our economy and our planet. You can find a link to that book at againstthegrain.org. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.